Peter B. Collins with News and Comment here on Thursday, June 21st, 2012. Every day, we're living with war. Neil Young with our introductory music today, and the violence continues unabated in Syria. And finally, in the official organ of the American government, the New York Times, surfaces some speculation that the CIA is arming rebels in Syria. Now, we have reported this for some time. Sibel Edmonds, my friend at BoilingFrogsPost.com, deserves credit. Last November, she reported that U.S. forces have been active in Turkey and in neighboring Jordan for almost a year now. And so for this element of truthiness to surface in the official corporate media is a bold step forward. And hopefully the Times will continue to try to do some actual reporting to determine what is going on in Syria and whom actually is fighting whom. And it is, of course, difficult from such a distance without independent journalists on the ground in any significant numbers. And earlier this week, we cited the report from the Frankfurt newspaper related to the May 25th massacre in the city of Hula. And the German report is 180 degrees from what you find in the corporate media in this country. They say the rebels conducted the executions and were able to blame it on government forces. And so as we attempt to get to the bottom of this and understand what's going on, it's nice to see the a crack of light and a little bit of truth in the New York Times. They report that American intelligence operatives in Turkey are hoping to find out exactly who these rebels are and cultivate sources and networks there. But you have to read between the lines to get the message that we are supplying rebels. We're doing it through surrogates. We're getting it paid for from Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and other neighboring countries. But they claim that currently there are no CIA officers in Syria itself. And that denial is enough to make me believe that it's probably true. The State Department has authorized $15 million in non-lethal aid, medical supplies, communications equipment to civilian opposition groups, and our military has drawn up plans for how coalition troops would secure Syria's sizable stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons if an all-out civil war develops. So, as I mentioned, Turkish Army vehicles have been delivering anti-tank weaponry to the border, where it is then smuggled into Syria. Turkey has repeatedly denied it was extending anything other than humanitarian aid, but we know that's bullshit, too. And the activists on the ground say that the United States has been consulted about these weapons transfers. So we're much more involved in the conflict in Syria than our country or our media let on. And the sooner we can really get to the bottom of it, the better off everybody will be. I want to recommend to you at Robert Parry's ConsortiumNews.com a commentary from Colonel Anright, who hands down is one of the people in this country I respect absolutely the most. She's the retired Army colonel. She's a co-founder of Code Pink for Peace. She's been a part of the Gaza Freedom Flotillas. And she is just an outspoken American on so many important issues. And she co-authored this op-ed with Colleen Rowley. Colleen has been on our program many times, the former FBI attorney who was in the Minneapolis office, tried to alert them prior to 9/11 about Zacharias Moussaoui, and became a powerful whistleblower from there. Their piece is a must-read, and I will link to it at peterbcollins.com in the show file for this News and Comment podcast. What they're talking about is the new leader of Amnesty International, The new executive director is Suzanne Nossel, N-O-S-S-E-L. She's a government insider who worked for Richard Holbrook under the Clinton administration back in the 90s. She was a deputy assistant secretary for international organizations at the Department of State. So she has worked most recently for Hillary Clinton. And she is aligned with the so-called humanitarian hawks, Samantha Power, Susan Rice, who's now the ambassador to the UN. And she is a proponent of what's called smart power, the use of military power as well as other forms to advance America's aims. And this, to me, is highly inconsistent with Amnesty International. And I don't know what the board at AI is thinking by hiring this individual. She is one of those people who is kind of a chameleon, at least at this point. And to see her running an important agency like Amnesty International gives me great pause. So this article is very well researched, includes quotes from Ms. Nossel, and I encourage you to read it. And at this point, I don't usually tell people things like this, but if you're a donor to Amnesty International, think twice before you send them a fresh check, will you? Meanwhile, a UN investigator is saying what I haven't heard from any American political leader, calling on the Obama administration to justify its policy of assassinating rather than capturing Al-Qaeda or Taliban suspects. Now, we know it's called the Kill or Capture Program. They have a video conference every Tuesday to decide who gets killed or captured. And hundreds of people have been killed under this program. We're able to identify only one individual who has been captured. And in a 28-page report, the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial summary or arbitrary executions, that's a mouthful, urged Washington to clarify the basis under international law that we claim our policy is linked to and legitimized by. The U.S. government should clarify the procedures in place to ensure that any targeted killing complies with international humanitarian law and human rights, and indicate the measures or strategies applied to prevent casualties. Fascinating. Also, there is a new book out about unmanned aerial drones written by Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink for Peace and an activist from here in San Francisco. I am reading the book right now and hope to present an interview with Medea about the drones within a week or so here at peterbcollins.com. The National Security Archive, using the Freedom of Information Act, based on footnotes from the report of the Hamilton-Cain-Zelikow Commission, the so-called 9/11 Commission, has forced the release of 120 documents from the CIA concerning 9/11. And as you may know, I'm not afraid to say this. We don't know the truth about 9/11. We have been lied to. The 9/11 Commission was a whitewash and a cover-up, and it has held. That doesn't mean we know the truth. It doesn't mean that people who demand the truth are nutty, tinfoil hat conspiracy theorists, and all that crap. No, we don't know the truth. And if people aren't intellectually honest enough to acknowledge that, then I'm sorry, I can't respect them. So what did we learn from this? The CIA had bin Laden in its crosshairs for a full year before 9/11. There were at least seven direct warnings that Al-Qaeda was intent on attacking the United States. We had drones in Afghanistan at the end of the Clinton administration, the beginning of the Bush administration, and in two incidents, they apparently located and identified Osama bin Laden and did nothing. There wasn't a kill or kill program at that time or a kill or capture program. And there also was infighting between the CIA and the Air Force because these drones were new toys at that point. And the Air Force told CIA that if it lost a drone, they'd have to pay for it. Oh, idiocy. It's just amazing. So the drone program began in September of 2000. That would have been under President Bill Clinton. That's when they swiftly, they say, observed a guy they thought was Osama bin Laden. They submitted a report to the National Security Council in December 2000, right during the transition to the Bush administration, and nothing happened. Then you have Condoleezza Rice trying to spin her way out of culpability. Quote, we were not left a comprehensive strategy to fight Al-Qaeda. Now, that is not true. One of the people held over from the Clinton administration was Richard Clark, the counterterrorism czar. He said he ran around the White House with his hair on fire, trying to get people like Condi Rice to pay attention. And now they want to rewrite that history. This article by Jordan Michael Smith about the new documents that have been released notes that George W. Bush spent the entire month of August that year on vacation at his ranch in Texas, and that George Tenet, the CIA director, said he didn't speak to Bush once that month. And then in September, Richard Clark called a meeting of the principals, but it was downgraded to their deputies. And, of course, nothing happened prior to 9/11 in any defensive way. And the other elements here, it says that there are nearly 50 CIA documents relating to such matters as the interrogation of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the intelligence gleaned from him, and yet none of them were declassified at all. And finally, the root cause. This is from a CIA report, February 2001. Violence between Israelis and the Palestinians is making Sunni extremists more willing to participate in attacks against U.S. interests. In another 9/11 story, here's another story related to 9/11, Dateline Islamabad, Pakistan. They have arrested a man named Naaman Meziche. They claim that he was a man linked to Al-Qaeda, some sort of a buddy of Mohammed Atta, the alleged leader of the hijacker group that came to the United States. And he was arrested trying to sneak out of Pakistan, apparently bound for Yemen or Somalia. And official sources say the arrest is now confirmation that intelligence cooperation between the U.S. and Pakistan is still occurring. Not really sure who this guy is, Meziche, but they're trying to build a case here. The New York Times contacted his wife, Miriam Fizazi. She says her husband didn't have any connection to 9/11. He divorced her and moved to the tribal belt of Pakistan so he could live under Sharia law. And so it'll be interesting to see if this turns into any kind of a major story. As I said, we haven't heard of this guy before. Not sure of his actual connection, if any. The Supreme Court today decided to let Fox Television and ABC off the hook for alleged broadcast indecency, but declined to actually rule on the underlying issue of broadcast bans on certain things. The issues were at Fox, the appearance of U2's Bono at an award show where he said it was fucking brilliant, and that's called a fleeting expletive now, and also partial nudity. I think it was a male's butt that was showing on NYPD Blue on ABC television. And the commission has decided to overturn the fines that the FCC levied on the networks because the FCC failed to give Fox or ABC fair notice prior to the broadcast in question that fleeting expletives and momentary nudity could be found actionably indecent. Now, I actually agree with the court on this issue. I don't think that there is any point in trying to limit speech that much by fining a network for what Bono said. And if people are offended by that, they really should get a life. But the interesting part of this is that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg voted with the majority, but she wanted to have a full hearing on the case and address the George Carlin rule, which is actually known as FCC versus Pacifica. It was the Pacifica Radio Group that played George Carlin's comedy performance with the seven dirty words that formed the baseline for regulation in this area. And Justice Ginsburg said that the Pacifica decision was wrong when it was issued and that time has changed and that we should reconsider it. And she said that in remarks before the American Constitution Society last week, the justice discussed the case, which involved televised banter between Nicole Richie and Paris Hilton, and suggested that there are gaps in the justice's knowledge of popular culture. The Paris Hiltons of this world, my law clerks told me, eagerly await this decision. So we'll have to live for another day and another case of fleeting expletives. Congress wants to make it safe for Monsanto to promote its genetically modified organisms, its frankenfoods, frankenseeds, and they have passed a bill, or this is an amendment to the farm bill that basically stops lawsuits against Monsanto in cases where its genetically modified seeds have drifted across a property line to somebody who didn't buy them. And because, quote, a stream of lawsuits have slowed approvals and created uncertainties for companies developing the modified plants, they said that this action by Congress will provide regulatory certainty. Now, this is the kind of case that the Republicans are talking about when they want to cut regulations and red tape. And this is a very dangerous issue. The courts should not be overridden by the Congress in protection of a corporation that is doing real damage to our ecosystems and really to the future of safe food on this planet. And so I think that's something worth noting, and I hope you'll follow up on that and see what else is going on there. Also, I have been watching this and have not yet commented on the summary dismissal last week of the president of the University of Virginia. Now, 2,000 faculty members, students, staff, and alumni are protesting the removal of President Teresa Sullivan, who was there for less than 2 years. And the speculation is that trustees of the university forced her resignation because she was unwilling to accept in promoting curriculum that would be stamped with approval by UVA, but delivered by for-profit universities, some of them using telecommuting, others, setting up brick-and-mortar campuses. And I'm not there. I don't know all the details, but her firing came as a surprise to almost everyone. One of the trustees, I believe a business school dean, was in the loop on this and apparently helped orchestrate this. And so I encourage you to watch this. Again, I don't pretend to be an expert on it, but it does smell. And I can pick up the scent all the way from Charlottesville, Virginia, out here in California. Tomorrow here at peterbcollins.com, I'm going to release a special podcast which focuses on California's prison system and the use of solitary confinement. It is barbaric, it's arbitrary, and in some cases, there are inmates who have been held in solitary in what are called security housing units, or SHUs, for as long as 40 years. This clearly, in my view, violates the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. And here is an excerpt from that podcast with psychiatrist Dr. Terry Coopers, who talks about the damage caused to an inmate from this kind of prolonged isolation imprisonment.
People who spend any amount of time in isolation develop a series of predictable series of symptoms, including very high anxiety. They can become paranoid. They become compulsive about cleaning their cell or pacing inside their cell. A universal symptom is they have trouble concentrating and they have trouble with memory, so much so that they actually stop reading, and reading would be one of the only activities they could do in their cell. I ask prisoners in that situation why they've stopped reading, and they say, I can't remember what I read 2 pages ago, so what's the use? And there's many other symptoms like that. One of them is mounting anger. which is almost universal in this kind of isolation. Think about it. If we were limited to being in our bathroom for months or years at a time, we'd be pretty angry much of the time, too.
You bet.
But the prisoners are very frightened that that anger will get out of control and they'll get in more trouble, and there will be worse punishment or longer time in isolation. So there's a pretty uniform, I've just scratched the surface of the symptoms, pretty uniform syndrome among people in solitary confinement. If anyone is at all prone or vulnerable to mental illness, those symptoms will reach the proportion of psychosis or suicide. And what I mean by that is where the relatively stable individual will start feeling anxious and paranoid, the person who is suffering from schizophrenia will actually have a psychotic episode. So the same stresses, the same traumas that cause the symptoms in the relatively stable person will cause the actual psychotic event or suicidal crisis in the individual prone to those mental illnesses.
That's Dr. Terry Coopers. Among others, he'll be featured in the podcast we release tomorrow about solitary confinement in the California prison system. And finally today, the soap opera that started in January here in San Francisco is lumbering along. And I call it a soap opera because one of the principals was a Venezuelan telenovela star who is married to a man who I know and have had some regard for, Ross Mercurimi. Mercurimi was elected sheriff here in San Francisco last fall, but he had not been sworn into office. And on New Year's Eve, he and his wife got into a fight, and he has pled guilty to a charge of bruising her arm by briefly attempting to detain her. And that was essentially a plea bargain from a case where they originally charged him with child endangerment and domestic violence. And it's a complicated case because the wife went to a neighbor who is not a practicing attorney but graduated from law school. Her name is Ivory Madison. Madison videotaped Eliana Lopez, the wife of Ross Mercurimi, and she said that Mr. Mercurimi had physically hurt her, and the mayor fired the sheriff. He actually suspended him without pay. And now the process is underway where the San Francisco Ethics Commission is evaluating the issues here and will make a recommendation to the city council, which is called the Board of Supervisors, and it requires 9 of 11 members to vote to remove Sheriff Mercurimi from office. And while Mercurimi handled this very badly, there's no doubt about that in my mind, I don't believe that he is guilty of any offense that causes his removal from office. And therefore, I have to support the notion that political reasons are behind this orchestrated effort to get him out of office. And the San Francisco Chronicle has been pretty blatant in its advocacy, both on the editorial page and in the news pages, against Sheriff Mercurimi. And what's unusual is that the token conservative columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, Deborah J. Saunders, is opposed to the removal of Mercurimi. And she's got it right. And often I can't say that about Deborah J. Saunders. There are a lot of things I don't agree with her about. But in this case, as opposed to her colleagues, I think she is measured, she is objective, and she makes the point that bruising an arm is not so outrageous that it should land the sheriff in jail or deny him the job that voters elected him to do. Hey, thanks for listening to today's news and comment. This podcast is FREE free, so share it far and wide with friends and people who need to hear it. Thanks.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.